This is Dr. Chad Edwards, and you're listening to podcast number 6 of Against the Grain.
Welcome to Against the Grain podcast with Dr. Chad Edwards, where he challenges the status quo when it comes to medicine. We get into hot topics in the medical field with real stories from real patients to help you on your way to a healthy lifestyle. Get ready, because we're about to go against the grain.
This is Brian Wilkes here with Real Doctor. Chad Edwards, how you doing?
Brian, I am doing amazing. I am ready to get rolling today. This is some good stuff.
I'm glad you feel good, because I feel not so good. It's flu season.
Are you scared?
Yeah, I'm terrified. We have, you know, when you have kids, I have two kids, and you have two kids, so you can relate to this, right?
Technically four.
Four kids, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Congratulations. Yeah,
thank you.
Newly married.
That's right.
Big family now.
Yep.
Right?
Family
awesome.
Man.
Awesome. So you understand, my kids are, well, kids aren't as young, but my kids are, I have two boys, one almost 2 and one almost 7, and it's like a petri dish at our house. They just bring everything home. We get everything, and it leads us to our subject today, which is, if I get the flu shot, then I won't get the flu, right? So there you go. But before we get started, let's talk about Revolution Health and Wellness Clinic.
Revolution Health and Wellness Clinic, man, that's an amazing place. Cash-based clinic, so you are actually in control of your own healthcare. You get the amount of time with the doctor that you want. We use all kinds of things, medical approach things. We do IV nutrition. We do bioidentical hormones. We look for the underlying cause of why you have a problem. So call us at 918-935-3636 to schedule your appointment. Certainly visit our website at revolutionhealth.org. Lots of contact information stuff there. You can read about us and call us and schedule your appointment.
Awesome. I go to Revolution Health. My dad goes to Revolution Health. My wife goes to Revolution Health. A lot of my friends go there now. And I'll tell you, one of the things I like about it is the way you're treated there. You really are treated first class. You got a lot of good people working for you there, Chad.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We are gifted.
Yeah. So
blessed.
Our other sponsor is Upper Cervical Health Centers. You know these guys personally, right?
I do. They are amazing people. Not your standard average chiropractic clinic looking at overall health. I think there's some statistic over there about...
Yeah, 75% improvement in overall health. Amazing.
Yep. So again, looking at... They're just not your, you know, pop your back, prop your neck, and get that feeling better. We're looking at overall health from a proactive perspective. So they go hand in hand a lot with what we do at Revolution Health. So they are amazing, amazing people looking for underlying causes, trying to get the physiology and the anatomy outlined correctly.
Awesome. You can call them at 918-742-2300, or you can look at them online at uppercervicaltulsa.com/newyou. So Chad, let's get right to the topic here.
Yeah, we got a lot to go over here.
Yeah, this is a good one. I mean, this is a conversation that my wife has with other wives, and it gets pretty passionate. Should you get the flu shot or not? So give us some answers here, man.
Well, let me first say that I am not opposed to immunization. It seems like there's this, you know, hard line in the sand, and, you know, do you immunize, period?
Right.
Do you not immunize, period? I think that immunization...
It does seem like there's
absolutely
like two kind of opposing views.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are some immunizations out there, not the topic of this podcast, and we'll go over a lot of that in the future. But there are some that have dramatically changed medicine and the impact of infectious disease on our overall health. I am not 100% hard-lined anti-immunization. So I just want to make that clear.
Tell us the difference between the flu shot immunization and is it in a different category than, obviously, is it carried differently? Is it a different makeup than your average child immunization, for example?
Well, so the biggest thing, and we'll get into the weeds of this, the biggest thing is that the other childhood immunizations, you know, actually work. You know, when it comes to like Haemophilus influenza type B, or what we call the Hib virus, or polio, like those vaccinations made a dramatic and profound difference. You know, we don't have polio anymore. We don't have smallpox. The vaccine essentially eradicated the illness. It was declared eradicated by the World Health Organization.
It worked.
So those immunizations work. Contrast that with the flu, which has not been eradicated. Different mechanisms and things like that. And I don't expect that the flu will actually ever be eradicated in the same way. But when it comes to the effectiveness, it's just over time. And this is not my opinion. This is the scientific data. And we're going to go over this. It just doesn't work in the way that we think it works. I'm not saying it's like has zero effect, but it's not what we've been told.
Well, you know, both of my kids have the flu vaccine, and I would say depends, you know, Jackson is 7. It depends on the year, but he still gets the flu.
Yeah, that, absolutely. And, you know, most of the time we think, I mean, you tell me your thought, or Marshall, you can weigh in on this. Do you?
Marshall's our behind the scenes guy. He's much more handsome and has a better voice than both of us. So I don't know why he's behind the scenes.
Well, he's got the height.
He's got the height. 6'7", this guy. He's single. We're going to give out his number at the end of the show. That's our new thing.
All you single ladies?
All you single ladies. That's right. We're going to have a sting with all you single ladies. But go ahead.
So the flu shot. Okay, so basically immunizations across the board, what we're doing is we're introducing some kind of antigen. And an antigen is supposed to stimulate your immune system to develop specific antibodies so that you're able to fight some kind of infection. Jonas Salk first came out with, you know, the first vaccine way back when, and you know, that made a very specific difference. And the idea of immunizations are that you prep the immune system, so when they do see an offender, they're immediately able to ramp up. The immune response. And we can talk more about the geeky stuff on the immune system in some other podcast if there's interest for that. But so you're developing antibodies so that when you see this stuff, you're ready to rock and roll. So the flu shot is an immunization that is designed to stimulate your immune system in a very specific way against certain strains of the flu.
Your own natural immune process.
That's correct.
Attack
that's correct.
The flu virus.
Now, in concept, I'm a big advocate for that. I think that it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. In concept, there are definitely some things that, you know, it just doesn't pan out quite that way when the rubber meets the road. So what I'd like to do, you know, with a lot of things, I like to understand the why. Where did we come from? You know, in order to understand the future, I think it's best that we understand the past.
So where did, in other words, where did the vaccine originate?
Exactly. So basically, you know, we had this big, massive flu pandemic in, you know, 1918, 1919, influenza pandemic, and it killed, estimates are as high as 50 million people worldwide. So this was a big problem. I mean,
crazy to think about that.
Killed people.
Crazy to think about that.
So, you know, there's a lot of fear associated with the flu, and that's understandable.
Was it a stronger version of the flu, or was it what we see today?
Well, there's what's called virulence factors. If you'll remember from 2009, we had the swine flu, which was predicted to, you know, cause a lot of deaths, and we had a lot of people that got really sick from that.
Right.
There's different virulence factors, and you know, there's you know, the hemagglutinin, and there's neuraminidase, and it'll be important to understand one of those. But basically, you got these proteins that are on the surface of the virus lipid envelope that make it more able to penetrate the respiratory epithelium, the cells in your respiratory tract, so that it can get in and infect those cells and do what it does. So there's some of them are more able to spread. They're more transmissible. Some of them have higher virulence factors. Some of them are more able to make you really stinking sick. Some of them make you, you know, a little bit sick. And when I say really stinking sick, I'm talking, you know, ICU kind of sick.
Right.
Not like, holy crap, I feel bad.
Not like you and I get sick.
Right.
Which is, for our wives, it's almost like an ER clinic at home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
For guys.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, big flu pandemic in the late 19-teens. And obviously, you know, that was occurring right about the same time as World War II. Well, the U.S. military, you know, I'm an Army guy, so the U.S. military had a big vested interest in making sure that their soldiers were healthy. So they definitely wanted to try to prevent something like this in the future. If your soldiers can't go out and fight, then your national defense would definitely suffer. So the military, you know, supported the development of a flu vaccine. So they first studied this flu vaccine in 1944 and found that it did decrease episodes of febrile illness. In other words, illness greater or illness with a temperature of greater than 99 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that sounds good, but that's not definitive. And there's a concept that we need to understand. We'll talk a little bit more about it as we go. But there's absolute risk versus relative risk. These absolute risk reduction, relative risk reduction. We'll talk about that'll be a theme as we go through scientific studies in the future. That will be a big theme. I don't think we talked about that before in the first
I don't think
podcast.
We have either.
Okay,
I agree.
So basically, absolute risk. You know, okay. So I like to think about it in terms of winning the lottery. If you buy one lottery ticket, then your absolute chance, if you want to call that risk, your absolute chance or risk of winning the lottery would be like what, one in a million or one in a bazillion or whatever it is, how many
right.
they sell. If you buy two lottery tickets, your chances are two in a million. But that's absolute risk or absolute chance. Relative risk is if you buy two tickets, you've doubled your chances. You have a 100% increase in your chances of winning the lottery. Conversely, if you only buy one, you've cut your chances by 50%.
Okay.
So those are true and accurate numbers, but it's skewed. It makes you think, well, crap, I don't want to cut my chances in half, or I do want to cut my risk in half, but you're talking about something that's one in a million or two in a million. You know, so right. really small chances. So a lot of data is reported in this.
Dumb and Dumber. You're saying there's a chance.
Exactly.
You're saying there's a chance.
Okay. So this relative risk stuff, it's very common, and we'll be talking more about that. So so they found that it did decrease incidence of these febrile illnesses, but a subsequent evaluation that they looked at in 1947 found that the incidence of disease was no different in vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. So basically, if you get the vaccine or if you don't get the vaccine, it didn't make any difference on whether or not you got the flu. That's what they noted in 1947.
Interesting.
All right.
That's
so
very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this the same pretty much clinical, vaccination is when they had in the 1940s that we take today?
Well,
you say?
Things definitely developed. We've learned more. We've refined techniques. We've, you know, those kinds of things. So I would argue, without knowing exactly what they used,
right.
I would argue that we're more effective today than we were back then.
But still, the initial foundational studies show, again, that there was no decrease in someone, you or I, let's say, you get the vaccine, I get the vaccine, doesn't necessarily prohibit.
Okay, so when we're getting the flu, going back to the scientific 40s. Studies, we are not looking at what is your chance.
Right.
We're looking at what is the chance of someone like you.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense.
So you have to look at it in generalizations because we're not looking that specifically. We're looking at, it's a statistical analysis.
And I would encourage anyone, I think it was either podcast one or two, to go back and look at how lab results are done and
yep.
compared. And
absolutely.
The same podcast where we talk about how people are measured in masses versus individuals.
Exactly.
I think that'd be helpful for people to listen to.
I totally agree with that. Okay, so 1957 had a new pandemic. It was called the Asian flu. Wasn't as bad as that one in the 1918, 1919 time frame, but we did see 1 to 2 million fatalities worldwide. So it still killed a lot of people. So again, more fear. It's a bad illness, bad disease. So they developed a vaccine to it. Millions of doses administered in the United States in response. Vaccine had no appreciable effect on the trend of the pandemic. So we're talking about millions of doses that were given. And from
wow.
a public health perspective, and did this really make any impact on how many people got the flu? We didn't notice a specific event. Now, when you're talking about these scientific studies, you have to be careful. Did they study the right people? Did they look? So we're just looking at, there was a whole lot of, you know, we're looking at like this big melting pot, and you just throw a bunch of flu vaccine into it, and then we say, did it make any difference in how many people got the flu? So I just want to use caution when we interpret mm-hmm. this data. Same with the data that we get today. It's more specific, but I think more skewed in many ways. Okay, so as we continue to go through here, so we started doing this routine vaccination in the 1960s, And, you know, so in this 1950 pandemic, when they didn't really see a difference, they explained that away as there was a failure of the flu vaccine because the immunization campaign that they started was too little too late. They said just didn't have enough time to make an impact. So in 1960, they started the first routine annual vaccination, and they emphasized these high-risk groups, including those over the age of 65 and individuals with chronic illness. By the early 1960s, we had routine vaccination policy adaptation. So we were adoption, I should say. So we were adopting routine vaccinations. So basically, everybody gets your flu shot, which is mm-hmm. what we hear today. But there was very little evidence to support this routine immunization policy because, as we can see in the 1940s and 1950s, it just didn't have an appreciable effect based on the information that we had. In 1964, Alexander Langmuir, he was an MD, MPH, so physician, master of public health. He was the chief epidemiologist at the CDC, published a paper, and his words were, reluctantly concluded that there is little progress to be reported. The severity of the epidemic of 1962-1963 demonstrate the failure to achieve effective control of excess mortality. So that was the chief epidemiologist. Epidemiology wow. is looking at the distribution of disease and illness and those kinds of things. And he basically said there it hasn't made a difference in how many people die from the flu.
And that is the CDC is the Center for Disease Control.
Correct.
And so let me ask you, when on that note, I get the impression that does the CDC actually make and has made the flu vaccine? I mean, they distribute the flu vaccination. How does that work?
No, we'll get into the manufacturer of the flu vaccination.
Okay.
And where do they get the strains?
Right.
So we'll get into that.
That's great. That'd be helpful to know. But the point is that he's saying in 1964 that it's have no real effective change
on excess to control that excess mortality because we're trying to prevent death.
Right.
Because when we look at these pandemics, big deal. We don't want people to die from this stuff.
What's your takeaway, and before we move on to, you know, current day, what's your takeaway on why, what is the reason for so many deaths proportionally then versus now? Is it healthcare system?
I think it's overall health, access to care,
right.
Health in general. You know, in the past, infectious disease was a big killer. We don't see as much of that today. Part of it's because, you know, if you get a secondary pneumonia, secondary infection,
right.
We were able to treat those things. You know, we didn't used to have ventilators. You know, we used to have an iron lung big with polio. Now we don't need an iron lung. We actually have ventilators. I mean, we have a lot of support things that we can do to help people in that regard. So I think that has a lot to do with mortality. And let me be very clear. You know, this podcast is against the grain.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're challenging mainstream dogma about how the delivery of healthcare and medical care. However, when it comes to trauma care, acute care illness, there is no other place on the planet I would rather be. And I've been multiple places. There is no other place on the planet that I would rather be if I'm going to get in a car accident, if I'm going to have surgery, I'm going to get sick, need an ICU. I want to be in this country.
Yeah,
we are the best in the world at trauma and acute care.
Yeah.
My issue is chronic illness and the prevention of things like diabetes. And that's where I think we've gone awry.
Well, so, I think to that point, I think there's a misperception of when I look at a statistic like this, that's probably been generated over time as we work through the facts here in the history of the flu vaccination, that a lot of the success that's been at least perceived to be a result of this vaccine has actually been a result of an improved healthcare system here at home for incidences like pneumonia.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we see a decline in those things because of the
absolutely.
Care. And
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And this paper by Langmuir, so he went on to say that he was questioning, should we be routinely vaccinating people against the flu? And the paper further said that routine immunization should be, he wondered whether it should be continued without better evidence to justify the major costs to the general public. Despite those questions, annual vaccination continued. In 1968, the CDC performed an actual randomized double-blinded trial. These are the gold standards of medical evidence trials to examine whether that vaccination made a difference on morbidity and mortality. And there, the authors of that study concluded, despite extensive use of influenza vaccines, attainment of improved morbidity and mortality has never been demonstrated. 1968. So we're seeing over time a trend. 1976, H1N1, the swine flu appeared, and large-scale efforts to immunize as many people as possible was launched. So you know, we think that the immunization is going to be helpful and beneficial. We've got to do something. But they didn't see the level of disease that they anticipated, but they did see something else. And it was one of the side effects that we can see with some of the flu vaccines. And it's a condition known as Guillain-Barré. And Guillain-Barré is basically, it's kind of an autoimmune cross-reactivity of the antibodies, and you begin to attack your own system, and it produces this progressive paralysis. So you are paralyzed, basically starting in your feet and working up. Now, that can be potentially fatal, and most of the time we recover from it, provided you receive adequate treatment in the short term. But that epidemic of Guillain-Barré led to the cancellation of that that widespread vaccination program. And in an analysis in 1977, the CDC concluded that influenza control had been, quote, generally ineffective, and that statistically valid community trials were needed. So we needed more research. In 1995, there was a major review by the U.S. FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which acknowledged the ongoing, quote, paucity of randomized trials. So again, we don't have enough data. We don't have enough data. We don't have enough data. Now, I'm seeing an emerging trend here suggesting that we're not seeing evidence from this. So that means we just don't have the studies to prove that it works. In other words, the underlying theme is we know this works. We just don't have the study to prove it works. Well, my concern is your outcome that this works and we try to find the data to fit that? Or is it being objective and saying, you know, maybe this really doesn't have as much effect as we think, and it just is what it is? So that's something that I want to file in the back of the brain. And they warned about serious methodologic flaws in many existing flu vaccine studies. Now, that is a big, big issue today, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. In 2000, the CDC performed a placebo-controlled trial. So we're, again, comparing two different groups, and found that vaccination when compared to placebo, quote, may not provide overall economic benefit in most years. So again, starting in the 1940s up through 2000, we're seeing some major organizations saying this just doesn't have that much effect. Regardless of all of that stuff, in 2004, the American Academy of Pediatrics said that annual influenza immunization for young children, household contacts, and healthcare providers should be performed in 2004, despite the lack of evidence to support that. So then they continued to expand these vaccine recommendations and said, well, we got to get everybody vaccinated. You and I have talked about the Cochrane Review. Mm-hmm. The Cochrane Review is a collaboration. It's a group of people that review data. They'll pull the relevant studies. They look for bias. They look for good quality studies. They look for consistency. And for the most part, they do a really, really good job. And in 2012, they did a systematic review and meta-analysis of all the available flu shot immunization data, examining the efficacy and effectiveness, and that's another term that we'll discuss in a second, of these licensed influenza vaccines and in patients with confirmed influenza illness. And their original statement was, recommendation to vaccinate the elderly was made without data for vaccine effectiveness or efficacy. And then they went on to say, we need a better vaccine and better studies to demonstrate its effectiveness. Again, that same theme. We're trying to prove that this stuff works, even though we are consistently having difficulty proving that. 2005 did a study of 33 season. So in other words, we got flu seasons. We're coming up on the flu season now, or we're in the flu season now. They did a study of 33 season national data set, and they attempted to reconcile the reduced all-cause mortality and morbidity found in some observational studies of influenza vaccination. And the fact that, quote, national influenza mortality rates among seniors increased in the 1980s and 90s as the senior vaccination rate coverage quadrupled. In other words, their mortality increased, but yet four times as many of them got the flu shot. So again, you're taking a big melting pot. You got the people in there. You're throwing in some vaccinations, and you're looking at what happened on the other side. And we threw in more flu vaccine, yet more people died.
Yeah. Now, so
we can't say yeah. cause and effect. Yeah. Cannot say that.
So if you look at the totality of from the 40s all the way to present day, it's hard to detect any public health impact, right? It's really hard to say.
That has not been demonstrated.
Right.
That's correct.
So how in the world, as a doctor, do you look at the landscape of that and say, you know, the rate at which people continue to be immunized from the flu, and how does that perpetuate itself? I mean, how does the average doctor in a clinic not have these availability of these same studies and the availability of the same knowledge? What's the counter? I mean, how can they justify their position?
Well, it's because we are taught. We are creatures of what we've been taught. We've been taught. We're told by the CDC. We're told by...
The CDC is saying that that it's ineffective, though, in some cases.
But if you pull up the CDC's website and, you know, basically just ask the question, what should we do about flu? Their very first recommendation is get your flu shot.
But there's no overwhelming evidence to suggest that it works.
Correct, but you have to dig to look for that.
And why? Why do you think this is perpetuated from the CDC?
Well, I think some of it is the... I mean, certainly you've got conspiracy theorists that'll say this is a big conspiracy and the government's trying to tell us what to do, and maybe. I'm just not a conspiracy. I just refuse to to accept some
well,
kind of conspiracy.
Well, having worked in the government, I can tell you they're not that smart or organized. I can almost promise you. The conspiracy theory is to cover up how dumb and inadequate they are. I can tell you right now.
I get it.
It's almost like a guy that doesn't do his job.
Right.
What was it? Office Space, the guy with the stapler in the basement. That's the government. Don't take my stapler. He said my stapler. You know, that's the government. The government is not a high-end, sophisticated CIA agent in most cases.
I get it.
Not happening. Yeah.
But, you know, again, you look at, you know, this kind of concept, you know, resonates throughout. For example, and I don't want to go off on this topic too much, and we'll talk more about this in the future, but when you look at dietary recommendations for cardiovascular disease, we'll talk about no more than 30% of your calories from fat, no more than 10% from saturated fat, blah, 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 blah. Any idea where that comes from?
The government.
It does. It comes from in the 1970s.
Right.
George McGovern was the chair on some nutritional, I don't remember the name of his committee, but they were getting disbanded and they decided to come up with one more recommendation, and they had some nutritionists come in. They had a kind of senatorial
right.
committee
right.
and they listened to, I think it was like 3 days of testimony. And at the end of this, they hired a writer to come in and summarize everything that was done. Now, this writer was not a nutrition writer, didn't know science, all those things. And he's supposed to write all this stuff up. So he didn't know what to write up. So he goes to one of the nutritionists and got his perspective, and his perspective was his biased, you know, right or wrong, but his biased perspective on right. the way things should be. He wrote that stuff up, and that was what was published as the senatorial recommendation.
Wow. See, now I think you have to view what's going on here in terms that everyone can understand. Think if anyone listening right now, they think about just the people in their office, right? You've got an eclectic group of people in your office. The government is the guy who's not doing his job, who's kind of lazy, but actually has a nice position within the company, right?
Yeah, let's back up. And so you say you used yeah. to work in the government. Let people know, what does that mean? I mean, like, were you a postal employee? Or?
Yeah, I was a yeah, sorted mail, which
I don't mean that as a knock.
Which I told I don't know. I totally figured it all out, right, in the mailroom. I was the executive director of a conservative leadership political action committee, which basically meant that I raised money. I worked on Capitol Hill and I raised a large amount of money for presidential, gubernatorial, Senate candidates, congressional candidates across the U.S. And so I got a front row seat how things operate. Because I was at the, when you're raising money in Washington, D.C., you find out a lot more than if you're just working on the Hill, right? So
right.
I did work on the Hill for Dick Armey, and I went to I was trained at the Leadership Institute. So I know Washington very, very well. I graduated from the Leadership Institute there.
And you've met people like George Bush and Bill
sure,
Clinton and
absolutely.
Those things. I remember you talking about watching Bill Clinton's prowess in working the room.
Yeah, he's very good, very good. I mean, he's your typical politician. I don't know what this has to do with the flu vaccine, but I will say that he is the guy in the office that is he's your sales guy, right? He's your consummate sales guy. But to that point, you have a lot of different personalities in the government, but people need to understand one thing about the government. They're always behind the eight ball. They're always behind the eight ball. I'll give you an example of that. When I was in Washington, D.C., I was there in 2000, which is a great time to be in Washington, D.C., right? Because you have the contract with America. If anybody's old enough to remember all that, Newt Gingrich.
Gingrich.
I was a Republican, so still am a Republican. And it was a good time to be a Republican, right? And then, of course, came the election in 2000, you know, and the Al Gore, George Bush thing. So you get to see a lot of the face of politics. And what you begin to realize is I was there in 2000, and I went, I had not been back since 2000. I came back to Oklahoma. We got married, and I came back in this last year.
You and your wife, not you and I.
Yeah, you
just
and I did
clear.
Not. Yeah, did I say you and I?
No, you just said we got married.
Because you choose to do these podcasts at 6 a.m. that I would ever say you and I. It's not on my mind. but I came back recently. I was invited to the Benjamin Netanyahu speech, and I went back. What's interesting about Washington, and it all relates to this topic, is that all the places that I've been and then come back to, it was as if time had stood still. You know, they talk about Cuba and how Cuba hasn't changed, that people are driving old cars and, you know, it's still in the 1960s. In Washington, people are still talking about the same things they talked about a decade ago, still using the same stories that they talked about, still even down to the dress, to the places that they ate. The world has changed and Washington has not. That's the bottom line, right? At all.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a conservative, I like some things that don't change, right, of course, but I also want to see progress.
Right.
On both sides of the aisle, there's been no progress. And I'll go back to my original point. The government is the guy in your office or girl in your office that has a relatively high position within your company, but everybody knows they don't really do anything. And then when it's time to come to the boardroom, they throw out things that no one can necessarily disprove, but helps them promote themselves. And I see this flu vaccine as one of those things. I can only imagine, although I don't have the facts, that the CDC covers their, again, if you compare to that person in your office, covers their rear by saying, no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. The flu vaccine doesn't work. Like, you know, off to the side, if you will, right?
Right.
But you should get it because we've got an answer for it. Nobody's getting the flu, right? But they also know, somewhat clever in knowing that the improved healthcare environments has decreased the risk of death and flu because of the assistance that you said. You know, the hospitals have gotten better at treating pneumonia and those type of things. So I absolutely believe, have seen firsthand many cases like this, maybe not in vaccine, but many cases where the government and government workers generally are very reactive rather than proactive in dealing with these types of situations. And I think you can point to this as absolutely being one of those cases. Is very systemic to how government works.
Right. And you have insight into that obviously
right.
I don't have.
Right.
And that's amazing input. And I think that's really good. You know, from my perspective, this is just something that was recommended, and it's kind of like, you know, that,
right.
That, traditional, you know, Baptist kind of thing. Well, we always sit in the same pew. We do it this way because we've always done it. And there's no good evidence to do that.
No. And I have to say, this show is that we've got a stinger for this. You ready? Let's go into this topic.
Against the grain.
As if we haven't been going against the grain already.
Exactly.
It is true. When I think one of your passions, Chad, is I think throughout history, we see this, and especially in the healthcare industry, we see this herd type of mentality where big profit is made from people just believing in what someone says, not necessarily being good for those good group of people.
Right.
I mean, we can go all the way back to the Reformation,
right.
Whether it be religion, but I think religion and politics and healthcare are three big ones that that people, if you look back, generation after generation, people are being misled. And
absolutely,
I think your passion is to bring truth to some of these topics.
Absolutely. And I'm going to kind of rapid fire a couple of things here because I want to get some data out. I want to get some studies out, but I want to do it quickly and I don't want to bore people with this stuff. But I'm going to read, this is a paper from Medscape. Now, Medscape is, you know, an internet site that is mainstream medical stuff. So this is mainstream medical, and I'm going to read a little bit of this thing. They say, if the reason for flu vaccination is that the flu is such a serious disease, then relevant outcomes are whether vaccination improves morbidity and mortality from the flu. However, after decades of vaccine use, it is hard to detect any public impact, health impact. This is in stark contrast to other routine vaccinations such as polio and Hib that we mentioned earlier, where introduction to the vaccine led to obvious decline of the disease. They go on to say, we are pediatricians and we believe in childhood immunizations. Many vaccines have provided immense public health value. We simply question whether the policy of routine influenza vaccination has outpaced the data supporting its use.
Wow.
That is mainstream medical stuff. So that's from one of the things. Now, let me read a couple other things. So,
but we still think you should get it.
Exactly.
But get it. Right?
All right. So let me read a couple other things here. So from the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine in October 2008, and these are going to be summarized. I've got this on my website. It'll be in the show notes. Giving the flu shot to young children had no impact on doctor's office visits nor hospitalizations related to the flu during two flu seasons. The researchers stated significant influenza vaccine effectiveness could not be demonstrated for any season, age, or setting. From The Lancet, major medical publication, August 2008, flu vaccination did not decrease risk of developing pneumonia in older people. From the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine in September 2008, the 51% reduction in mortality with vaccination initially observed in patients with pneumonia did not have, who did not have influenza was most likely a result of confounding. Previous observational studies may have overestimated mortality benefits of influenza vaccination. From The Lancet Infectious Disease, October 2007, quote, we conclude that frailty selection bias and use of non-specific endpoints such as all-cause mortality have led cohort studies to greatly exaggerate vaccine benefits. Then we get into the Cochrane collaboration, and they started in 2006. There's another one in 2010. And we've got them on, well, I'll just read this one. This was from 2010. No effect was shown for specific outcomes such as laboratory proven influenza, pneumonia, and death from pneumonia. We've got from 2010, this is looking at vaccination versus unvaccinated people and what's the risk of getting flu. 4% of unvaccinated versus 1% of vaccinated persons developed flu-like symptoms. Notice it's flu-like symptoms, not influenza. Hmm. In the relatively uncommon circumstances of vaccine matching the viral circulating strain. In other words, we know that there's different types of flu, right? There's H1N1, there's H5N2, there's like all these different ones. And the World Health Organization has these collaboration centers where they're getting, you know, people that get the flu, they've got these sites in these labs that will get strains, mm-hmm. and they will take that data and send it to the collaboration centers, which feeds that up to the World Health Organization. And that's how they say on an annual basis, they say, these are the trends that we're seeing. This is what we think is going to be the influenza strain most likely to cause the most problem. And there's a Northern Hemisphere and a Southern Hemisphere version of the flu shot. And that's somewhat new. And so those are, that's how they get the strains, and then they release that to manufacturers for the flu vaccination.
Right,
You've got the potential for, in fact, the high potential that there's a mismatch. In other words, you think you're getting flu version one, and this is actually flu version two that's out floating around. And we don't know that, yet we still say, oh, but you should still get your flu shot. And it may not be a match. And so in this case, they're saying in the, this is a quote, in the relatively uncommon circumstance of vaccine matching, it's uncommon that we get it right, is what they just said. Matching the viral circulating strain and high circulation. However, under normal circumstances, the numbers were 2% of unvaccinated and 1% of vaccinated people that get the flu. So when we talk about relative risk reduction, if under normal circumstances, there's a 50% reduction in flu.
Wow.
Because it was 2% versus 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So 50% reduction. But in absolute risk, it's 1% difference.
Wow. Well, I think this is definitely a hot topic for people. And I think we could go on and on, but our time is finished for this particular podcast. I think we're going to do some possibly more shows on Chad on the difference between the mist and the shot and some more extensive discussion around the flu and vaccines in general.
Right.
And I think it'll be interesting information for people. This is one of these shows that I'm not even sure how to tell people, you know, what are the action steps that they take from here? Do they get the flu vaccine or do they not? Because I think there's some more questions that they probably have.
Yeah.
And I would highly recommend if they don't have a doctor that will sit down and talk to them about it, specifically with kids, right? If they have kids and they're making some of these new mothers out there that are making these big decisions on whether to vaccinate their kids with the flu or albeit other vaccinations, probably would do well to come sit and talk to you at your clinic, Revolution Health and Wellness Clinic.
Absolutely. Let me do one more thing and then I'll tie
you
up.
Yeah.
So the most recent review of the data was the Cochrane collaboration from 2012. And in this review, they showed the efficacy of the vaccine, but discussed the differences between efficacy and effectiveness. They did note significant side effects. As stated, influenza vaccines were associated with serious harms, such as narcolepsy and febrile convulsions, and those were in kids. This review includes trials funded by the industry. They discuss, you know, much of that. But the review showed that reliable evidence on influenza vaccines is thin, but there is evidence of widespread manipulation and conclusions and spurious notoriety of the studies. The content and conclusions of this review should be interpreted in light of this finding. In other words, so your action steps are you can go out and find data to say you should absolutely get your flu shot. That stuff's out there. I read a paper the other day that said that getting the flu shot causes a 60% reduction in your chances of getting the flu. Zero references cited on that.
Wow.
None. So did they just make that up?
Just maybe an observational piece. Yeah.
So I think the action steps are ask questions.
Yeah.
Where did this come from? And unfortunately, your average primary care doc doesn't know.
Yeah, it's the whole point of the show, right? I mean, that's your
right.
passion is for people to take back their own healthcare.
Right.
Until they do that, they're never going to be in a position to make good decisions.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm not saying you should or should not get your flu shot. I can't substitute, you know, as a over the radio broadcast as a medical recommendation. That's between you and your doctor. My goal is you need to ask some questions. The data behind this is not what we've been told.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the whole point of the show, and is that, you know, don't be intimidated by a doctor. Don't be intimidated by their title. If something doesn't make sense, ask a question, study it, and understand it. Take back your health, right?
Absolutely.
All right, my man. It's you know, this is a passionate subject. Chad's sweating over there. I can see it. Marshall, you still with us?
I'm with you.
You
want
to take it out?
I'll take us out.
You got
out.
Some cool music?
Here we go.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast with Dr. Chad Edwards. Tune in next week where we'll be going against the grain.